Hello, and welcome to Gilead. My name is Soren Hotchire, and I'm the Communications and Office Admin here. CARE congregations were asked to preach on the importance of workforce development for Black LGBTQ folks and how accomplices can participate in that work. So here is Reverend Vince Amlin preaching about the parables of the talents and his interpretation of it.
For a couple summers in college, I helped run this program of character education through recreation at summer camps in Indianapolis. And as the culmination of our time with each camp full of kids, they would meet us at this ropes course for a few last games and a trip down the zip line. And one of the challenges that we took them through on that last day was the wall. The kids were divided into smaller groups of like 7 or 8 and placed in front of a wall that was maybe 10 feet high. I think there was a rope on one side. And the goal, we told them, was to get their entire team from one side to the other. As with all the other challenges that we gave them over the course of the summer, you start to notice patterns about how teams take on these challenges. On the wall, groups tended to fall in 2 categories. First were the groups in which the tallest, strongest climber, usually a counselor, declared to the rest of the group that they would just, let's face it, that he would just climb over first so they could be on the other side to help everyone down. And usually before anyone else in the group could really respond, the person bounded up the rope and over the wall and down on the other side, letting everyone else know how easy it was. Sometimes then, not to be outdone, the second tallest person would join them, and then, with plenty of help ready on the far side of the wall, the team finally realized that the hard part was getting up the wall, not so much down the wall. And the 6th shortest, often youngest people would struggle among themselves to try to get a couple of others over, their counselor coaching them kind of impatiently from the other side until they gave up in defeat. The other kind of group, the most successful group, started with the folks who would have the hardest time going over on their own, which now that I say it is pretty obvious, but maybe the shortest or the youngest, their teams lifted them easily up and over, and then on to the next person and the next until the best climbers could scramble over on their own at the end. Those were the teams that won. It was interesting how many of the counselors on that first kind of team, after it was all over, still believed that they at least had succeeded, even if their team had failed. I mean, they had gotten to the other side. It was only the rest of them that lost. What does success look like? What does it mean to win? Jesus tells this story. A person was going on a long journey, and I'll stop right at the beginning here and say, in the actual, like, biblical text, it uses all this slave and master language, which I am not going to use because I don't want to use it, but I also don't want to ignore or hide the fact that it's there in the text. A person was going on a long journey, and as they prepared to leave, they split up their money between 3 of their workers to use while their boss was away. To the first, the boss gave 5 talents. To the second, 2 talents, and to the third, 1. One source I read said that a talent was 15 years' wages of a day laborer, like 15 years' worth of minimum wage. Not a small amount of money, even 1 talent. So the first person went and traded with their 5 talents and earned 5 more. And the second person traded with their 2 talents and earned 2 more. But the third person was afraid. They worried about losing that 1 talent, so much money. What would their boss do? So they buried it in the ground, because at least there it would be safe. And then the boss returned and called the servants together for an accounting. And the first presented all 10 talents and was rewarded. And the second brought the 4 talents that they'd accumulated, and they were rewarded. And the third one came trembling and said, "I knew you were a cutthroat boss, and I was afraid to lose what you had given me, so I hid it in the ground Here, take back what is yours. And the boss got angry and said, if you knew I was cutthroat, then why didn't you at least give it to the bankers so I could have earned a little interest on it? But now I'm going to take that one talent I gave you and give it to the person with 10. Now I want to point out, I did not choose this story. Pastor Marcus and Pastor Jamie from Lighthouse chose this story. So if you think this is a terrible story for me to preach on, I'm with you. And if you think it's especially a terrible story for me to preach on about Black LGBTQ plus workforce development, I'm especially with you. This weird story about like the power of compound interest. Like if my assignment were to preach about like why it's important to fully fund your IRA, this is the text I'm going for. It's not a sermon I can preach until I'm living it. This is a perfect parable for our capitalistic society. This is a story about individuals competing in the marketplace, a story about maximizing profits, a story about trying to make as much money as you can and not being like overly concerned about your neighbor, which is a weird choice for an organization which exists to promote equity. And I did notice that when they originally sent out the citation, they conveniently left out the last two verses of the story where Jesus says that those who have much will get more, and those who have little, even that will be taken away. And also something about gnashing of teeth. All of which, if I didn't know better, I would say was almost the opposite of equity. But this was the passage that Marcus and Jamie gave me, so I tried to take a second look at it. I thought about the lens that I was bringing to it. A modern, American, white, cis, hetero, male lens. Of course, through that lens, it looked like individualism and capitalism, because everything does, even if I try to resist it. But that's not the world in which Jesus tells this story. And it's not the lens through which Jamie and Marcus were reading it or asking me to read it. They were telling me this is not a story of individualism and capitalism, but of collective liberation. And I trust them, and I trust Jesus. So I took another look. And I realized this story isn't about individuals at all. The first two recipients, they don't just double their money miraculously like fishes and loaves. They go into the community and use it. They go out and trade with it. And the difference for that third person is that they're too afraid to do that, afraid that what they have will be taken or diminished. That if they bring it to the community, they will end up with less than they started with. And in one reading, yes, we can blame him for being too timid or not savvy enough, but in another reading, a more liberating reading, we could believe him. We could trust that it's true, that this is the system that he lives in. And if so, this is not a story contrasting individuals and their money management. It's a story about different economies, different communities. In one, resources are valued and shared and multiplied, and it leads to flourishing. The first and second people know that they can bring what they have to the community and more will be made of it. But in the other system, resources are scarce, devalued, hoarded, and diminished, and it leads to fear and waste. The third person knows that in their community, sharing what you have is a good way to lose it. Better to bury it and stand guard over it, so at least you have what little you started with. Which one, Jesus is asking, sounds like God's dream for the world? Trusting Marcus and Jamie when they told me this was a story of liberation, I also saw that it wasn't a story about maximizing profits. The boss says that they would have been content with even a little bit of interest, and I think actually they would have been content with even less. In a different parable earlier in Matthew, Jesus tells the story of another servant who was forgiven for losing 10,000 talents, 150,000 years' wages in debt, just wiped out. This isn't a story about maximizing profit. Jesus isn't concerned about how much money they end up with in the end, but what they did with it, whether they did anything at all. In the positive system, the money moves around. It goes between people, and it creates prosperity, not just for these two people, but for everyone. The more it's used, the better things are for all. In the other system, it never has that chance. The boss says, at least if you had given it to the bank, even one exchange, something could have been made of it, some small loan or something. This isn't a story about maximizing profits, but maximizing exchange, interaction, connection. Because, of course, this isn't actually a story about money at all. The money was always a metaphor, surprise, for the gifts that we've been given, for the giftedness with which we are entrusted, the unique value that we each bring that has been placed into our care from the beginning of God's dream of us. The money was always a metaphor for what the theologian Howard Thurman calls the genuine in us. In his famous commencement address at Spelman, Thurman said, "There is something in every one of you that waits, listens for the sound of the genuine in yourself. And if you cannot hear it, you will never find whatever it is for which you are searching. And if you hear it and then do not follow it, it was better that you had never been born." This is not a story about individuals maximizing profits, seeing how much money they can make. This is a story about an economy of the genuine, a community that works to maximize connection and exchange in hopes of seeing how much of the giftedness around us we can bring out, bring to bear in creating a world where all can flourish. Jesus says, if you want to know what heaven is like, if you want to know about God's dream for the world, picture a community where you can bring the gifts that God has placed in you without fear that they will be diminished. Picture that when you share them with others in this community, you find different and beautiful giftedness in each of your neighbors. And as you exchange those gifts, they are multiplied. That's what success looks like, Jesus says. That's what it means to win in God's world. In his video about Lighthouse's Black LGBTQ plus workforce development conference this year, Jamie Fraser says it another way. When those who experience compounded marginality like Black LGBTQ people win, everyone in the organization wins. When the one who has been marginalized and marginalized and marginalized, forced to the outside of the outside of the outside, when that one instead becomes the center, when that person's experience and giftedness becomes the hub around which we gather, when the community exists to maximize that one's connectedness, that one's well-being, that one's benefit, when that person wins, the whole team wins. In God's economy, it's the only way to win. If we believe this story is a story of liberation, we can see how hollow a victory is, how hollow a victory it is when we make it to the other side of the wall by ourselves and strand everyone else. When we use our privilege for personal advancement, when we believe the story is about us as individuals, what a waste. How much is lost with no one to exchange gifts with? Thurman says, there is something in you that waits and listens for the sound of the genuine in other people. And if you can't hear it, then you are reduced by that much. That's God's economy. It's not a story about compound interest and profit margins. It's a story of compounded marginality met with a prophetic interest in human flourishing. Flourishing not for the individual, but for the community. That's the challenge, to get everyone over to the other side. That's what it means to win. None of us is free until all of us are free. None of us is saved until all of us are saved.